You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 30th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House, with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller.
Coming up on today's programme, Chinese courtesans, Dutch masters and World War II Portugal, just some of the themes in this week's novels up for review.
We'll also be finding out what to do if you're kicking your heels in the City of Light this weekend. Let our man in Paris be your guide.
As home to Europe's largest community of Muslim people, Middle Eastern and North African films are becoming increasingly talked about here in Paris, and for the second year in a row, the suburban cinema Le Trianon is hosting the Festival of Franco-Arab Film.
We'll take a trip to Texas to get an update on some of the best culture coming out of the southern states of the US.
But it's an encyclopedic museum and has some absolutely unbelievable collections that you wouldn't really expect, so it's nice to go and see something different. It's just sort of the unexpected pleasures that you see as you travel along.
Plus, we'll welcome back a man with his finger on the musical pulse, a Norwegian producer, Mattis Witt. We'll stop off in Berlin to get the critics' view on the city, and our design editor will tell us why roller blinds and a cardboard box are worth taking a second look at.
So lots to look forward to, as usual, on this week's edition of The Review. Yes, hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House. I'm Andrew Muller. Good afternoon, Emma.
Hello, Andrew. How's your cultural week been?
It has largely revolved, actually, the last month. There's a new record, which I think is my favourite album of the year, which I'm terrifically excited about.
You have one of those every day.
Not quite, but this one's, it's the new one by Jason Isbell, who did come in here to play last year at Midori House with his previous album, Here We Rest. Jason used to be a sort of the third string songwriter in Drive-By Truckers and left a while ago now. This is his fourth solo album, but it is a massive leap forward, the new one. It's called Southeastern.
What sort of style are we talking?
It's you would call it sort of country Americana, but it's a very unusual country Americana record in that it's a very, very good album about sobering up and getting married.
Okay, whereas so not a descent into hell, but a redemption.
I know, great country records tend to be about the other thing, i.e. sort of getting drunk and ending up in the doghouse.
I thought that was the blues.
That's
the aftermath, isn't it?
That's generally the aftermath. It's a downward spiral. But he has actually cleaned up and got married and calmed down and made a completely fantastic album about
it. How desperately dull. Well done him.
Exactly.
My cultural week followed a ridiculous cultural week 2 weeks ago when I looked at Paris Photo and then I went to a couple of films and it all became very cultural. So I hid from the London cold and hunkered down with the new series of Borgen, which has just hit the British screens, and fell in love all over again. The first two series I adored. This, of course, is the amazing series about the lead character is Birgit Nørborg, who has been the Prime Minister of Denmark. In the third series, there has been a huge change. She is no longer Prime Minister of Denmark. The girl who was her sort of counterbalance, but in a different area of life, she was a television news anchor. This is Katrine. Katrine is now gone into politics with Birgit Nørborg. There is single parenthood. There is shaved heads. There is cow. There are pigs with antibiotics. It is brilliant, and I'm terribly happy that it is back and available.
So you should be. I, on the other hand, get well and truly enough of all that sort of thing at home. You are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. And first, we are considering books. The books up for review this week are hefty in size and wide in subject scope. They range from the aftermath of a bomb blast in a museum and the effects on one of its victims, to infidelity in 1940s Lisbon and growing up among Chinese courtesans.
Kathy Rensenbrink is a book editor of The Bookseller, and she joins us now to go through some of the best pages on offer, and many pages there are too. I mean, Andrew just mentioned Kathy. Welcome, by the way. Lovely to have
Hello,
you in the studio. Just mentioned that the books in this week are hefty in size. Are we noticing a sort of a new wave of ambition in writers? Just big, big books.
It's an interesting point, actually. I chose them because I wanted to choose things that were international for your audience rather than sort of just concentrate on English things. So,
and clearly readers who work out.
Yes, absolutely. But there has been a lot of debate lately about long books because there's... because obviously the Luminaries won the Man Booker Prize as well, and that's a huge brick of a book. actually, despite having chosen extremely long books, I do have a partiality for short, intense novels. You ever have me back again.
is the long book becoming a thing, though? Because I can't figure out what effect on the size of novel the e-reader may have. Because on the one hand, it all but abolishes production costs, so which has always been one of the things mitigating against writing 2 million word epics, or so one of my publishers once told me when I'd written something which was getting there. It was weird. Anyway, but or does it mean that the epics are now less likely because then people are now assuming that there's less attention span among readers?
It's a very interesting question, and I think as everything with e-reading, it's still very much open to debate. Certainly the I think it's interesting when you don't know how long something is. So
I have a huge problem that with my e-reader, mm-hmm. which I hate and have written about extensively and spoken about my hatred of, but my sad marriage to it. I hate the fact that the book is always measured in percentages. Mm-hmm. I would dearly love to know what a page looks like on an e-reader.
Well, you see, I use an iPad to read and that doesn't percentage you.
Right.
So I don't have that experience. When I read The Goldfinch, I read it as a manuscript and knew nothing about it. I was reading it very early.
So you would have had arms like a wrestler then, Kathy.
I read it as an e-manuscript, so I didn't know how long it was going to be. And my e-reader doesn't tell you. It doesn't say how long it is. So as I was reading it, every so often I think, I wonder how much more of it there is, because there's been so much already.
This is an interesting question about how books get structured, though, because did you find it altered your experience of how you read it and assimilated it?
I definitely, at some point, I thought, I mean, I was very taken from it with it straight away and very engaged with the story. But at some point, I thought, I feel I've been reading for a very long time. And then only at the end, I thought this is going to be, when this is a paper book, this is going to be a huge, huge book. But I quite enjoy I sort of enjoy the carnival atmosphere of not knowing, so when I'm looking at lots of manuscripts and choosing what to read at some level, I quite like to, inject a bit of tension by surprising myself. Who knows? So sometimes there will be a situation where I'm still trying to turn the page on something and I realise, it's finished.
I remember reading George Eliot's Middlemarch at university and thinking to myself, it's one of those books that no matter how far you're through it, there are always another 200 pages to go. And this is the impression I get when I'm on an e-reader. Anyway, let's have a look at The Goldfinch. Mm-hmm. Donna Tartt's novel, enormous. Enormous not just in size, but also in scope, because it has a brilliant beginning. Mm-hmm. And yet it then follows the story of one of the main character involved in the first sort of literally explosive chapter.
Yeah, so it opens in Amsterdam. Theo is in a hotel room trying to read. He can't read Dutch. He's trying to work out whether the newspaper headlines say anything about him. Blood-spattered clothes in the hotel room, blood on the walls, and we don't know what's happened. And before we find out what's happened, we go back in time and there's an explosion in a museum. Theo and his mother are in a museum and there's an explosion and his mother dies in the explosion and he takes a painting of the Goldfinch. The last thing they were doing before this bomb exploded was they were looking at a painting called The Goldfinch by Carol Fabritius, who's a Dutch artist. I'll admit to I'm not very up on art. And again, so as I was reading this book, not knowing anything about it, I didn't actually know whether or not that was a real painting.
It is, and it's a very lovely one.
Mm.
It's a very small one. And this is 17th century, and it is of a goldfinch, on a little perch on a wall, and it is supposed to have a tromlöy effect that they kept goldfinches at the time. And so if you had the painting, it would give the impression that you didn't have a live bird. You didn't have just a painting, you had a live bird. But that's by the by, because the goldfinch and the painting itself is woven through the rest of the book, isn't it, as Theo's life takes all manner of very unpleasant turns.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is back to that thing of it being a huge book of scope, because you could pick any angle to go into this book. You could say it's about art, you could say it's about loss, it's probably about both. It's about how you try to recover from something intensely traumatic. It's about friendship. There's vast amounts of drug taking. In that way that you always like to learn things when you read, I kept thinking, gosh, didn't know that.
So, so So you learned a lot about drug taking.
I did, yes. I sort of felt I had a walk on the wild side with the drugs, as well as a walk on the cultural side with the art. And again, I didn't know what it was about when I started reading it. I happened to be in Holland because my husband's Dutch. We were on a fairly regular trip over there. And then it was great to go to the Rijksmuseum and look at the Fabricius paintings that are there. And so I did feel I was in this sort of this fog of different cultural things sort of hitting me from all angles. There's the art, there's the words. It's amazingly written. And it took her 10 years to write. And I think in this time of brand authors and everybody writing a book a year and everybody under pressure to publish and to a certain extent living in a sea of free content, I think to read something that's been laboured over is
special.
Does it special.
Feel like it's taken 10 years to write? It feels like it's taken 10 years to read. Not in a bad way.
No, I mean it feels like it's worth 10 years, I think. I don't think it feels laboured, but you can I think it's an astonishing achievement. I think it's a book that you read and feel that the author is an artist who in some way is on some sort of mission to enlighten, which isn't something I feel when I read every book.
About things beyond just drug taking and Dutch art, though, presumably.
I think so. I felt it was very, when I came to the end, I did have one of those sort of. I feel at the end, it kind of pulls it all together, and it's talking about. I think she uses the expression the rainbow's edge. There's a rainbow's edge where art exists and magic exists and love exists. And you think, actually, this is just all about everyone trying to live their fractured lives, make sense of their existence, carry on when things go wrong, often horribly. So I felt at the end it came very back to quite simple, sort of quite simple but profound existential questions.
That is The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. That's out now across the world. Let's move on to a smaller tome, but quite a neat, mean little book, I'd argue. David Leavitt, The Two Hotel Frankfurts. Tell us about that, Kathy.
This is, I love this book. I've loved David Leavitt since reading Martin Bowman, one of his earlier novels. He's not actually very well known in the UK. And so I, again, hoped that this book, hope this book might bring him to a wider audience. This is about two couples who wash up in Lisbon at the start of the Second World War. They're American, and like many Americans and people of all nationality, they've been living a sort of a flotsam and jetsam life in Europe. And now the Second World War is about to start, and they have to get out of Europe. So they're in Lisbon, they're waiting for a place on a boat, the SS Manhattan, as is many people. Lisbon is full of people who are trying to get away, or to a certain extent don't want to get away. Because I think one of the interesting things about the book is the dramatic irony of, obviously, we know what's about to happen to these, well, to everyone in Europe. But the writer sort of doesn't know, because he is writing it from the from time in the future, but the characters themselves don't know what's about to happen.
And as a result, when I read it, I got the impression that these were four very unpleasant, bored people who had lived a very spoiled life. One of the main characters, Julia, the wife of the narrator, is this very spoiled little girl who wants to stay in Paris because, well, she wanted to live in Paris. She lives in Paris. She's not satisfied with it. Mm. And of course, the Nazis basically push the Americans out of Europe, and they always have to stay one step ahead. And I was very, very unimpressed with any of the characters when I read the first bit. I got the impression that this would actually make an incredibly good stage play or a very good film, mm-hmm. because there are so many scenes in it involving conversation. And then, of course, there is a pivotal scene where I don't think we're going to be ruining too many people's mm-hmm. lives, where the two men in the partnerships have an affair with each other, mm-hmm. And it all obviously ends up awfully, and everybody has a terrible time. But it needed something like that, like the affair, for me to actually be interested with them. I spent the first half of the book thinking, I don't really care about you an awful lot. Just, pack yes. up, go back to New York and deal with
and
it.
And don't you think that it is that dramatic irony? So Julia, who I agree with you, does come across as very spoiled. She's also Jewish. And again, I think the denouement of the book plays into that. But there is this sort of rather horrible sense of tension, because Julia doesn't want to go on the boat. She wants to stay in Europe. So as the reader, you just want to say to her, get on the boat. Stop messing about. Stop creating problems. Just get on the boat and get out of there.
Grow up.
As you were pointing out, though, this is always the weirdness of historical fiction, that we know kind of what's going to happen, mm-hmm. even if they don't. And does he sort of play with it at that level? Because there's been a couple of novels recently, thinking of Flora Nelly's 1913, Laurent Binet's HHHH, mm. which I loved. But really do actually play with the conventions of the historical novel and start actually thinking and start actually talking out loud during the book about the fact that, you know, obviously I'm setting everybody up here for a fall because we all know what's actually going to happen. Does it address that at all?
He does, but only at the end. So for the most of the novel, you think you're reading a fairly conventional... Well, I tell you what it is. It's a great piece of misdirection. You think that the sort of the controversial bit is the gay love affair, which obviously in 1940 would have been more shocking. So you think that's the controversial thing, and you're reading and reading along, and then the end does flip everything, I think. Mm. And then you kind of feel, ah. So, you know, up until that point, you're thinking, you know, oh, because I love the Laurent Binet as well. And so up until that point, you slightly think, oh, this guy could have done to read the Laurent Binet. And then right at the end, you think, ah, no, I should have trusted.
It turns out he has. Yeah.
It's funny, though, that you get individual people's perceptions of a war that hasn't really happened yet.
Yes.
You don't... I think a lot of the spiel that's trying to sell this book is quite wrong, insofar as it says it's set in 1940 Lisbon, the war is on the way. And you don't get any indication, actually, that the war is remotely touching them yet, because they're still
because
having...
It isn't
touching them, and there's not very much historical context at all. There's none. It's just a small play between four of them.
Actually, thinking about it, I've never worked this out before. I do actually have a soft spot for those sorts of books because I really like Mary Wesley's novels that deal with, there's quite a lot of phony war stuff. You know, nothing's really happened yet, but the servants have disappeared, so people are having to learn to cut up their own cabbage. You know, it's that sort of thing.
The humanity.
A wonderful line in a Mary Wesley novel where this sort of quite posh character says to the waitress, and again, this is before any bombs have fallen, and she says, you know, are there any profiteroles or has the war put a stop?
Good Lord, but it did feel
so
very
much
that like
kind
that.
Of, it's that period before things happened. I was reminded that actually recently when there was a storm in... There was going to be the big storm hitting the UK. And I know it did hit lots of places, but it wasn't anywhere near me. I saw no evidence of this. There's just a light breeze. And it was reminding me of the phony war. And I kept thinking, because I was sort of saying on Twitter, has there been a storm? Is there a storm? And then I said, it will serve me right if I get hurricaned off a la Mary Poppins, because I'm effectively doing what the characters in this novel are doing.
Well, indeed. I mean, you can joke, but a panel of my back fence blew down. we should move on to Amy Tan and the Valley of Amazement.
Amy Tan, of course, the author of The Joy Luck Club, which made her very famous and made the book very famous. I never really liked it, but I won't tell anyone, especially not on the radio. This is her new novel, The Valley of Amazement. What are your thoughts on it, Kath?
Well, I did like The Joy Luck Club, and I think this is probably her best novel since, actually. Because I think there's always has been that slight struggle when you write a book that is so sort of amazing and I think achieves so much of what you want to say that it's a bit difficult to follow up with. But I really liked this. This is set in, well, it's set in Shanghai and then also part of it in San Francisco. But it's about a girl called Violet or Vivi who grows up the mixed race daughter of her American courtesan mother. And then later on in the novel, you realise that her mother ended up in Shanghai because she became infatuated with a Chinese painter and followed him to Shanghai. But as it opens, she's the sort of the owner of a courtesan house, a house of pleasure. She's called Lucia, but the name they call her is Lulu Mimi, and it's known as the House of Lulu Mimi. So from this little girl's eyes, we learn all about what it's like to live in this situation. What it actually reminded me of in a really peculiar way was it reminded me of Gone with the Wind in that sense of an entirely lost world and a lost civilization.
And a lost girl.
And women sort of falling in love despite their better judgment.
But it's also Amy Tan going back to mothers versus daughters, east versus west.
Yeah, the mothers and daughters thing is very well done. There's this wonderful bit where, so Violet is telling us about how the courtesan house works. And that is in itself fascinating. The detail around both the sort of the decor, the food, but also the sex. Some of the euphemisms are wonderful. They talk about entering the pavilion. They talk about rousing the warrior. There's a lot more stuff as well, which I won't say because I thought it might be a bit too dirty for the radio.
It's lunchtime.
It's fine. But there's this great bit when she talks about her mother and her mother's charm. And one of the things her mother does is whenever she sees anyone, that's right, because the big thing about this courtesan house is this is where where cultures meet. This is where Chinese people and Western people are doing business together, the only place that does. And her mother will go up to any man who arrives and say to him, "You're just the one I hope to see." And this has a great effect. And then Violet tells us that that's what her mother also says to her. So she knows this is what her, she knows her mother kind of charms her in this sort of generic, non-personal way. And I thought that was very striking.
Well, on that duplicitous note, Kathy Rensenbrink, book editor of The Bookseller, thank you very much for joining us here on The Review. Stay with us. Up next, our design editor, Tom Morris, will be giving us his take on an exhibition celebrating Japanese craft.
The Arctic has inspired artists for centuries with tales of adventure and exploration. Monocle Films made its own expedition to Denmark to see the Louisiana Museum's Arctic exhibition to seek out the past and the present of this mythic place.
As nations are vying for the north, negotiating trade routes and expanding development, and the Arctic landscape threatens to disappear, this exhibition takes a visionary stance that activates dialogue on every level, from science to pop culture.
Arctic Inspiration, premiering in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. For the next month and a half, London's Pace Gallery explores Minge, a Japanese craft movement from the 1920s and 30s.
It was created by the philosopher and critic Sotsu Yanagi and includes all manner of art forms from sculpture, ceramics and textile. This new exhibition not only showcases the Minge movement itself, but also places new works next to the originals. Our design editor Tom Morris went to see the exhibition and here's what he made of it.
Roller blinds, a stainless steel teapot and a cardboard box. Hardly the things you'd expect to exemplify one of the most intriguing philosophical design movements of 20th century Japan. Minge was a school of thought that became popular in the 1920s and 30s, off the back of the arts and crafts movement in 19th century Europe. It saw the value in the everyday, in charming, run-of-the-mill, utilitarian items, at a time when the world was modernising, industrialising, and methods of manufacturing were on the bound. Instead of just celebrating the handmade, Minge actually tried to make a link between it and industrial design. This show, at Pace London, explores it by way of 80 works produced by 25 different talents. The gallery has been cleverly transformed into one long viewing deck, a deep 3D stage where the players range from a Charlotte Perriand orientally bamboo chair to Sori Yanagi's eternally elegant butterfly stool. It's an eclectic bunch, arranged quite simply like items in a home, which is appropriate given the fact that in addition to some of these design icons, you'll also find simple ceramics and one of my favourite pieces in the show, some Sori Yanagi kitchen tongs. Pitting artwork by a range of slightly impenetrable contemporary artists alongside the older Minge pieces suddenly helps make sense of them. Stephen Preener's primary coloured painted roller blinds hanging from the ceiling, works I've never quite got, swiftly take on the guise of Japanese scrolls. Trisha Donnelly, one of America's more oblique talents, has contributed a stainless steel sculpture that looks a little bit like an enlarged bottle opener, which tingles with an industrial simplicity next to the teapots by Sori Yanagi. Curator Nicholas Tremblay has done a fantastic job making sense of a pan-discipline, pan-global selection of objects. He plays a game of snakes and ladders, weaving around the world and back and forth between the decades. Curators always like to use that buzzword, dialogues, as Tremblay does in his fascinating essay that accompanies the show. The title of the exhibition even asks you a question. Minge, are you here? Overall, though, what he's done is simple. When it comes to dialogue and inanimate objects having conversations, he simply let beautiful things speak for themselves. I can't remember the last time I cooed over a teapot in such a way. For Monocle, I'm Tom Morris.
Our teapot cooer Tom Morris there. Now, Minge's influence can be seen all around the world, but if you're in London and you would like to see that exhibition and that teapot, it's on at the Pace Gallery until the 18th of January next year.
It's time now for our weekly music review on The Review here on Monocle 24. And today we welcome back the Norwegian curator and producer Mattis Witt, who has a selection of new music.
Now, when Mattis isn't busy creating and curating music projects, he's booking festivals and managing a record label. So, Mattis, welcome back to the studio. Thank you for taking time out. You sound like an awfully busy gentleman.
I Yes, I am.
I mean, for you've been back on the review. This is not your first time visit to the review. But for those of us who weren't able to hear you last time, described as a Norwegian curator and producer, just quickly recap what you do.
I run a Norwegian project that seeks out to explore common ground between more electronic music, alternative music, and the more sort of institutionalized classical music. So what I do is create projects that fuse those two schools of music, and I order commission to this project.
Andrew.
No, I was just saying, what are you specifically working on right now?
Right now, over the last 2 years, I've been working on a project with Panta the Prince. That's called Panta the Prince and the Bell Laboratory, to where we have a big ensemble of bells. It's like a symphony of bells. So we've been traveling around with that, bringing it latest to Australia 2 weeks ago. And yeah, now we're back here.
Where are you actually showing these? This lovely experiment. It's a very niche thing that you do, so you probably require quite a niche environment in which to express it.
Yeah, I guess it happens in more traditional concert halls. We've done it at the Barbican, the main hall there. I would say 4 weeks ago. We did it in La Cigale in Paris. We done it at the Primavera Festival in Barcelona, Maison Symphonique. So I guess more classical, traditional concert halls. But since it is sort of a fuse between electronic sort of dance music and symphony, you sort of have the thing where they sit down in the first half of the show, but then at the end, everyone gets up and dance.
Well, you've brought in a bunch of new sounds for us to listen to, which we will get to without that much further ado. The first track is by Empress Of. Briefly, if you would, introduce them.
Yeah, Empress Of is a girl from Brooklyn. I guess my favorite part of December is sort of looking towards what I think will be the next big thing in 2014. And I really think she will be that. She's amazing. She's called Lorelei, and she's an amazing songwriter and lyricist.
But this is Empress Of with Realize You.
That was Empress Of and Realize You. It was the choice of Mattis Witt, today's guest on the review. I really loved that when I heard it. And the way you've described it is, you say it's like a torch song from another dimension.
What did I say?
A torch song, a song where a woman singing her, you know, bearing her heart.
Yeah,
to the
yeah,
world.
Yeah. She's definitely sort of spreading her frustrations of a relationship. I like these songs. You know, it really just hits your heart when she sings.
At the risk of giving away my vast age, I thought that had something of Cocteau Twins about it.
Yeah, yeah. You can definitely say that. I definitely feel it's sort of like a synth poppy. Project from her, and she does everything herself, and she's just so on point with her references. So I think she will be the next big thing in 2014.
Do you DJ as well, or do you?
Yeah.
And so you'd be playing this as well?
No, not necessarily. I guess I'm more dark club music when I play. Actually, the next act you will play will be more of a thing I would DJ.
Well, this is, which is Pionel. Pionel or Pionel?
Pionel.
Pionel, I was right the first time. This is Invisible Amenza. Pionel, the second track chosen by this week's guest music reviewer, Norwegian producer and curator Mattis Witt. The 80s never really quite went away, did they? That keeps reminding me of sort of weird things like Visage.
No, yeah. It definitely has sort of a fun Italo-tinged vibe to it. Yeah, Miguel just signed to, or his name is Miguel, he just signed to London's Young Turks label. So I'm sure we'll see a lot more of him. He's been touring with the XX the last year. So,
how did you first discover that
track? Actually, he's a good friend of mine. We come from the same sort of label crew based around John Talabot. So we all used to release music on the same sort of independent music label called Ivern Discs, based out of Barcelona.
Are you still releasing, or are you just concentrating solely on your electroclassical projects?
I do both. My own production is more on sort of the club music side. And then, the curation takes up a lot of time, I would say. Yeah.
And what are you looking for when you're producing now? What are you looking for?
When I'm curating?
When you're curating.
When I'm curating, I guess I'm trying to find projects that make sense, where it makes sense to fuse these two traditions, you know. It needs to be with people that sort of have an open mind from both scenes and understand each other. So I would say I just look for originality and just an open mind to break down some barriers.
Well, we journey yet further in space and time for your third selection. This is William Onyebor with Good Name. Introduce him first, if you would.
Yeah, William Onyebor is a guy that made music in the 70s in Nigeria. The music didn't get released publicly until now. It's been released by David Byrne's label, Luaka Bop. Last month, it's some of the most sort of futuristic space funk music, and he holds fans like Damon Albarn and Damn Funk and Caribou and Fortet. He was just so ahead of his time. And actually, Luaka Bop now have ventured to try and find William Onyebor because he's been lost for like 30 years.
There's a whole hidden history of 60s, 70s, 80s music from all over Africa. I mean, the Ethiopiques reissues dredged up one small corner of it from East Africa, but there is a continent's worth of this stuff still awaiting discovery.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what they've been doing with their World Psychedelic Classic series at Luaka Bop. The last one they released was Brazilian artist Timaya. That was also sort of unheard for the rest of the world up until now. So a good friend of mine runs the label, and he just a month ago found William Onyebor in the jungle, living in a castle.
He lives in a castle
in the jungle.
Yeah, he's a reborn Christian, and he refused to talk about his music.
What a shame.
Well, this is castle dwelling jungle resident William Onyebor from Nigeria with Good Name. I have a good name, I have a good name. And no money, no money, no money, no money, no money can buy my name. Do you have a good name? Do you have a good name? Then no money, no money, no money, no money, no money should buy your name. I mean what I am like that. That's William Onyebor, Good Name, sort of weirdo space funk from 1970s Nigeria.
Let's just add a little bit to the end of this story of William Onyebor, who you said now lives in a castle in the jungle.
Yeah.
You were saying that your friend is now going to spend some time with Mr. Onyebor.
Yeah. He went out there and they spent some time in like silence. For the first 2 days it was just silence, but then they started talking together, and I now think he refers to Eric, my friend, as his son. And he's going to go back to Christmas for Christmas to celebrate Christmas with Mr. Onyebor as well, and try and lure him back out in the public. Yeah.
Does this all have a second motive? He isn't just spending time with William Onyebor, he wants him to start making records again.
I think he wants him to start acknowledging his records and talk about them again, because he denounced all the music. I think he refers to his old music as sort of the devil's music, and now that he's a born-again Christian, he just won't acknowledge it.
Fine. Thank you very much. It's a more
readable, I think, sort of artist bio than you usually get sent. Because usually, if you've ended up, as I have, reading a lot of these things over the years, it is all sort of like, they met in a bar in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Yippee.
No, it's also fun as well, because he studied. They just keep on finding out interesting stuff about his life. Like, he studied law at Oxford. And he's a Russian film scholar as well. So,
of course.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Makes sense.
William Onyebo there. I don't think that'll be the last we'll be hearing of him, even no matter what Mr. Onyebo might have to say about it. Mattis, let's move on to our next track, War Paint. Tell us about this.
Yeah, War Paint is signed to the same label, Rough Trade Records, here in London, as the Panther, the Prince and the Bell Arbitory project also came out on. It's just four girls. My favorite live band of all. It's like psychedelic rock music done in a like totally free and intuitive way.
And this is from their self-titled album, which is out January the 21st in the US on Rough Trade, January 20th here in the UK. They will play us out. Mattias Witt, thank you very much for joining us again here on the review on Monocle 24. This is War Paint with Love Is to Die. Was War Paint the last choice of this week's guest music reviewer here on the review, Mattis Witt. You are listening to the review on Monocle 24.
Time now to take the pulse on a city around the world to hear what's coming up over the next few days. Today's destination is Paris. Monocle's man in the French capital is Tom Burgess Watson, and he's here to guide us through it.
Generating plenty of discussion at dinner parties across Paris, the masculine exhibition at the Musée d'Orsay challenges the artistic world to afford the male nude the same degree of visibility as the female form, taking you on a two centuries long journey up to the present day with a collection of some 200 paintings, sculptures and photos, all of them capturing the naked man. The museum warns visitors that some people could be shocked by the exhibits, in particular young children. The Musée d'Orsay is open each day from Tuesday to Sunday from 9:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. City Hall, or Hôtel de Ville, is hosting an exhibition of one of the greatest photographers ever to capture the City of Light on film. Born in Transylvania, Julius Halat, who became later known by his nickname of Brassailles, started photographing Paris in the late 1920s, and the Pour l'amour de Paris exhibition shows you a number of facets of the city, introducing you not only to some of the chicest people of the day, but also to some of the more down-at-heel Parisians. Entrance to Hôtel de Ville is free of charge. As home to Europe's largest community of Muslim people, Middle Eastern and North African films are becoming increasingly talked about here in Paris, and for the second year in a row, the suburban cinema Le Trianon is hosting the Festival of Franco-Arab Film. Well, this year's winning entry will be announced on Saturday evening. And amongst the 21 films in the running, the highly acclaimed Saudi Arabian film Wajda, which tells the story of a little girl who, despite the cultural barriers, dreams of one day owning a bicycle. And finally, Alberto D'Ascola, who's better known as Alba Rosi, might have been born and bred in Sicily, but he's now one of the most respected reggae musicians on the planet. The Mobo award-winning artist is in the French capital this weekend, giving a concert on Saturday evening at the Zenith Paris. That's in the 19th arrondissement. For Monocle, in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess Watson.
Still blazing, still blazing, still blazing. Can judge a poet so amazing. Give by the strength and protection, keep praising. Whoa, yeah, yeah, yeah. More time is this and nothing, no one. And what me get is not what.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll hop across the border to Germany for the critic's view from Berlin.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. Alexander Forbes, Berlin Bureau Chief of BlueInArtInfo.com, is Berlin's young art critic about town, writing every exhibition in the capital up as fast as he can, for better and for worse, for one of the international art world's best visited websites.
He met Berlin correspondent Kimberly Bradley to talk about what he's doing.
One thing I'm pretty excited about is this Belgian artist trio called Leo Gabin is premiering a new film at Perez Projects. The show's called Tallahassee. So the film is called Crack Up at the Race Riots, which is based on the novel by Harmony Korine, which is set in Florida in the late 1980s, I think. And they're known for kind of taking YouTube videos and piecing them together. The last thing that I saw of theirs was kind of focused on teenage girl culture. It was kind of like girls dancing around in their bedrooms. Very weird. But this one, they took all footage from Florida and have pieced together footage that somehow is based on this novel by Harmony Korine, where I think he has a quote in that past where he said the Jewish people sit in trees, and it's like a weird kind of dystopian situation. Anyways, all found footage, and thus far you see kind of people riding around in the Florida countryside, and literally it's located in the armpit of Florida, and I think there's maybe a reason for that. But, and again, with the show, they'll have some kind of abstract paintings along with it, but I think this film is going to be something really interesting.
Can you talk a little bit about Perez Project's space, the space itself? It's relatively new for the gallery. They moved there a few months ago, I think, right?
They moved there, I guess, yeah, about 6 to 8 months ago. They opened up a massive new space on Karl Marx Allee, which is kind of a little bit of a dead zone for galleries, and was kind of a move back. They'd moved to Mitte and had this much smaller space right in the middle of the city. But this allows them a lot more, especially a lot more wall space. I think they've been much more focused on painting a lot lately.
Speaking of galleries moving around, one of the eminent players in Berlin's art world is closing a large space and opening up two smaller ones and celebrating 40 years. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so Max Hetzler, which is, like you say, I mean, he had this massive space. I would say it's definitively the biggest gallery space in Berlin, in Wedding, which is outside of the city. And they're just monumental museum-style spaces. And that one's coming to a close. It's also his 40th anniversary, like you said, and he's brought together works by all of the artists in his program right now. Interestingly, all new work, which I thought was a really nice way of approaching the anniversary show to kind of really look forward. It's really amazing work. A site-specific wall painting by Bridget Riley and another big metal and op art sculpture by her. It's a massive painting of Lindsay Lohan by Richard Prince from the series, which he did a film with her after kind of all of her trials and tribulations of the past years. And yeah, across the board, just Christopher Wool did a new painting, and really, really a museum quality kind of look at a blue chip swath of artists that you might not usually get to see in Berlin as well.
You mentioned performance that's taking place at Hebel am Ufer. You could explain it a little bit. But I'm wondering if it's going to be performance art or theater, or maybe you don't even know that. Could you describe what this upcoming event is?
It's a theater production, performance, whatever you want to call it, by this Belgian actor collective or performance art collective called De Warme Winkel, which is funded by the EU, and it's called We Are Your Friends. It's traveling to Brussels, Prague, Lisbon, Toulouse, Amsterdam, and they're looking at kind of this kind of myth of the European Union and how it can, or the viability, I guess, of the European Union. I saw some previews of it where they're trying to sing some Portuguese song to get to better know what they might encounter in Lisbon, and another one that they're all naked, and a pair of the two women in the collective are sitting on a couch, and, you know, they said that this is like really what it must feel like to be, I think, Germany in the EU or something, you know, really stable and secure in your position. So I don't know. It's a little bit out there, but I think it might be a really kind of fun and interesting take on European politics with all that's going on currently about that.
That was a critic, Alexander Forbes, talking to Kimberly Bradley there in Berlin. Now, Texas has been somewhat unfairly saddled over the years with a reputation of being a cultural as well as very real desert. The state is working harder, however, to overturn this assumption. And earlier, Andrew spoke to Charlotte Burns. She's art market editor for the Art newspaper, about her recent art-themed Texas road trip.
Charlotte, I wanted to ask first about Marfa, because I've always been intrigued by the idea of the place myself, this tiny little town in the middle of Texas, which exists as a sort of self-contained art hub. What's it actually like to visit?
It's strange and marvellous at the same time. It's really a pilgrimage to get there. You have to fly into one of two destinations, and we went to Midland, Odessa. As you fly overhead on the smallest plane I've ever been on before, you just see oil fields for as far as the eye can stretch, all the way to the horizon. You land and zoom along highways which smell of oil seeping in the window, and everybody driving extremely fast, and then sort of pull off and start heading through a mountain and arrive 3 hours later to Marfa. And it's this very small town. It sort of looks like where you might want to shoot a Western. And you get out and we walked to Chinati, which immediately made everybody realize that we were not local, because everybody drives. And so we walked there and went around Chinati. It was just an absolute pleasure to be there. I've always wanted to go. And so the opportunity to actually go and look at, you know, this sort of completely unusual thing in the middle of nowhere in West Texas.
So is it worth the trip, or the pilgrimage, as you put it?
It's absolutely worth it. And the pilgrimage is sort of part of the process, I think.
So what do you actually see when you get to Marfa?
Well, Marfa itself is a small town. It's not particularly humming. I think that the cultural trade is the only thing bringing in the major business nowadays. And at one point, Donald Judd was, in fact, the largest employer in Marfa when he was really in the midst of creating Chinati, the foundation. So you get there, you get to your hotel or wherever you're staying, and then you can go to Chinati, which is the Donald Judd founded indoor-outdoor center. It's a former military barracks, so you go in and out of sheds, which have works by Dan Flavin, Carl Andre, Judd himself, those sort of famous stacked boxes, rows and rows of these Judd boxes. Lots of things in the landscape too, like Kleist Oldenburg. And they have an ongoing mission too. I mean, next year they're going to be realizing one of Judd's architectural visions. So that's Chinati, which is just amazing. Then there's Ballroom Chinati, a much younger enterprise, and they're working on building a huge public drive-through, which will be for art and music, because music's such a big thing in Texas. And there's also a couple of other art institutions around the place. So it's really a kind of cultural town, and you just wander around and you see the art, and that's kind of all there is to do. A little bit of shopping maybe if you wanted to, and food, but really art. There's not much else. It's not like visiting London where your attention's distracted.
Well, there's slightly more going on, of course, in Texas's two bigger cities, Houston and Dallas, which you've also visited. Dallas first, of course, has been under scrutiny for reasons it would probably prefer to forget these last few weeks, around the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. But what is Dallas's art scene like?
It's really undergoing a moment of huge growth. Dallas has long had a reputation for being kind of flashy, and it's definitely, you know, the more ostentatious Texan city out of that and Houston. But it actually had a huge recession that people don't really remember, that began in the 1980s, and recovery only sort of seriously kicked in the mid-2000s. But now it has the fourth largest concentration of Fortune 500 companies in the US. And mostly the money's made through finance and technology, whereas it used to be oil, but that moved. So now there's a lot of sort of entrepreneurial immigration, and that's changed the city. You have these collectors who have kind of bandied together to give, they're promising to donate their gifts to the Dallas Museum of Arts. The Dallas Museum of Arts too has Maxwell Anderson as a relatively new director who has worked on making free admission, making the museum much more accessible. They're planning a bit of a facelift. It's kind of supremely Texan in the way that everything's driven by possibly private-public partnerships, but really the emphasis is on the private, which means that you can do things extremely quickly. They just built a green park where people can walk. It was built over a freeway. So now you can walk to the cultural district. And the cultural district itself is like a kind of roll call of star architects. There's been a huge amount of building going on there, and there's still more, yet more planned. So Dallas is really making a big push. Lots of it to do with contemporary art. And, you know, the collectors there are really pioneering this moment. They work together. They sort of collaborate. They're not in competition like you might find in, I don't know, New York. The collectors all have sort of distinct visions. You know, you look at the Hoffmans of Rachofsky and the Rose collections. They're all sort of distinct, and they will all ultimately go to the Dallas Museum of Arts, which is currently working with them. So it's very interesting. It's a completely unusual model.
Was there anything in particular among all those attractions which really struck you as worth making the trip for?
Well, the Dallas Museum of Arts, it's a sort of the oldest kid on the block, and it's often overlooked in favour of the more contemporary goings-on. But it's an encyclopedic museum and has some absolutely unbelievable collections that you wouldn't really expect. So it's nice to go and see something different. It's just sort of the unexpected pleasures that you see as you travel along. There's amazing collections in Philip Johnson houses. It's great architecture there. The individual collectors have really made a big push. The Nasher Sculpture Garden is terrific, although it's currently having a lot of problems with the glare from the tower next door to it, but hopefully that will all be sorted out because it's frying the lawn in the outdoor sculpture garden, which is obviously a big problem for them.
Moving along to Houston, which I know fancies itself as Dallas's slightly more refined cousin, but there is a rivalry between the two great Texan cities. Is Houston doing its best to keep up?
Well, Houston is sort of likes to see itself as older money to Dallas's newer money, although in truth, I mean, they're both pretty new cities to me as a European. Houston's very wealthy. It makes its money from oil, medicine, and lots of engineering because NASA's nearby. It's also incredibly ugly. It's this endless mass of freeways. It doesn't have zoning, so there's no urban center to it. So you could have a sort of supermarket next to a governmental building, next to an art museum, which is kind of a problem if you wanted to create a cohesive city. But at the same time, the cultural pockets there are extraordinary. You know, they have the fantastic Menil collection, which is announcing plans to expand in January. And on the grounds of the campus there, you have the Rothko Chapel, which is really a great thing to see. The Fine Arts Museum is also planning a huge expansion. It's raising $400 million to construct a third building. So there's a lot going on there too, and they hope to kind of address the scattered nature of all these isolated hubs by creating a cultural corridor through the urban centre. But that decision ultimately will lie with the property developers.
I mean, is there a sense that this is something Houston does need to work on to make itself more appealing? Because I have been there, you're right, it's not a terrifically attractive city.
I don't know, because I think it depends on who you're talking to. So if you're used to growing up in small higgledy-piggledy towns like I am, then it seems very strange to just drive endlessly and pass things with, you know, seeming sense of cohesion. But I think if you're from America, it's a much larger country, and perhaps it makes more sense to drive, you know, on these endless freeways. I think it would be good if they had a kind of urban centre. It would be nice to see a city centre. It felt strange not to have a kind of downtown area. But, you know, perhaps that will happen.
That was Charlotte Burns, the art market editor for the Art newspaper. And with that, we say goodbye from here, us here at Midori House. And thank you for listening. Our producers were Katie Bilbert and Fernanda Augusta Pacheco. Rosie Sells were as our researcher too. And our studio manager was Claire Urban.
Next week on The Review, we will look forward to analysing some new films with Alex Godfrey and getting a little taste of the Monocle Christmas fair.
But for now, from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller.
It's goodbye and thank you for listening, and have a great weekend.